Okay, good evening, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is Tuesday evening, December 2nd. And we're in the middle of Chapter 13. No doubt we'll finish that up tonight. And we have a lecture tonight, we have a lecture Thursday, and we have a lecture on Tuesday. And then your final is on Thursday of next week, not Thursday of this week. And I think that is that the 11th? Okay, and it's either, it will be in the room downstairs, 215, because I don't need a projector to give the test. And I'm not sure what chapters are going to be on it yet, but 13, 14, and what about 12? Did we get tested on 12 yet already?
Yeah.
Yeah. So 13, 14, maybe. 13, 14, I don't know, we'll see how it goes. Okay. All right, well, last time, which was a week from today, before Thanksgiving, we were talking a lot about blood. And we were talking about transfusion reactions. And when somebody has a transfusion reaction, which is a bad things are happening to a person after they have a blood transfusion, what's the process that is taking place? What's the name of that process? What produces a transfusion reaction? What's the name of the process? Yes, agglutination. And the best way to think of agglutination is what kind of reaction? Between what two? It's an antigen-antibody reaction. All right. The other thing you have to key on is where are the antigens located? On the surface of the cells. And where are the antibodies located? In the plasma. They're floating around inside the plasma. So that's agglutination. All right. The other kind of clumping reaction that we looked at was due to blood clotting. And blood clotting, what's the one, the scientific term for blood clotting? It's not agglutination because it's antibody antigen. Coagulation is it. Coagulation versus agglutination, and you should understand that the basic two fundamental processes are different. Agglutination is antibody antigen reaction, and what is coagulation? Yeah, it's a clotting. And what's forming during a clot? Fibrin. Fibrin formation, right? So fibrin formation happens during coagulation. All right, so that's blood clotting. And remember that the best way to think of that, at least when you're first starting out, remember it's a three-step process for coagulation. The last step is fibrin formation, okay? And so where does fibrin come from? Fibrinogen. And what converts fibrinogen to fibrin? There's an enzyme called thrombin. Okay, thrombin. All right, so you got to know that. So the very last step, step number three, is fibrin formation. When thrombin converts fibrinogen to fibrin, that's the third step. The second step is the formation of the enzyme that catalyzes the third step. So what's the enzyme that catalyzes the third step? What catalyzes, what converts fibrinogen to fibrin again? Thrombin, right? And thrombin is held in an inactive form in your blood until it's activated. What's the inactive form of thrombin called? Prothrombin, okay? All right, so that's the second step. The second step, when prothrombin gets converted to thrombin, right? The third step, fibrinogen to fibrin. So what converts prothrombin to thrombin? And that's the name of the first step. The first step is called prothrombin activator formation. So the first step is prothrombin activator formation. The second step is thrombin formation. And the third step is fibrin formation. All right, and if you're looking in your notes or the book, it's got many, many more steps and cofactors and clotting factors, and I want you to know those three. Okay? The first one is prothrombin activator formation. And what does prothrombin activator do? It activates prothrombin. And when prothrombin is activated, what does it become? Thrombin. Right. And when you have thrombin, what does it do? It activates fibrin. It converts fibrinogen to fibrin. Okay? So those are the three steps. Okay, so be familiar with the difference between coagulation and agglutination. And you should know something about those blood types too, the ABO system as well as the RH system. And if I give you a red blood cell, make sure that you can tell me what the blood type of that person is. Okay? How, if I give you a red blood cell, how can you determine what the blood type of that person is? Because there's an antigen. Yeah, I have to either draw or not draw antigens on the surface of that particular cell. Okay, great. So we're moving on to the pulmonary circulation and systemic circulation. Well, the heart, okay, has four chambers. How many valves? It's got four valves, right? And you should know all the names of the valves. There's two atrioventricular, two semilunar valves. And there are certainly two circulations. One circulation goes from the right ventricle through the lungs back to the left atrium. The systemic circulation leaves the left ventricle through the systemic circulation, comes back to the right atrium. All right, so here you see it. Let me get my pointer back. Oops. All right, so here you can see the two circulations, and as a matter of fact, let's just go over one other definition. What's an artery? A vessel that carries blood away from the heart. It's going to be high pressure. What's a vein? Carries blood back to the heart. It's low pressure because a fluid will always flow from high pressure to low pressure, just like the fusion molecules will move from the area of high concentration to low concentration. So blood will always flow from an artery to a vein because arteries have higher pressure than veins, or veins always have lower pressure than arteries. And in between arteries and veins, what do we have? What kind of vascular structure? A capillary. And what's the essential nature of a capillary? What's happening there? Exchange takes place, right? So absorption or secretion. And why does exchange take place in a capillary but not an artery or vein? You have to think back to some anatomy because you had to learn layers of blood vessels. And because a capillary is just one simple layer, right? It's very thin. Arteries and veins are way too thick to allow for diffusion. That's why capillaries have exchange or allow for exchange. So the pulmonary circulation has one capillary bed in the lungs, and the systemic circulation has one capillary bed in your tissues someplace other than the lungs, and exchange takes place. Okay, and you should probably look at this chart just to review from anatomy where oxygen is and all that kind of stuff. So could you tell me the name of a vein that is high in oxygen? Usually you would think an artery is high in oxygen. But just tell me the name of the vein that's high in oxygen, and it is the pulmonary vein. And the reason is because it's coming back from the lungs after it has absorbed all that oxygen and exchanged what? CO2 out. So give me the name of an artery that is low in oxygen. Nope, vena cava is a vein. Give me the name of an artery. That is, that's the pulmonary artery, right? So it's actually quite simple, but it's kind of a mind teaser because the pulmonary circulation is exactly backwards compared to the systemic circulation. So that's really the point I want to make. All right, arteries and veins are defined exactly the same way, but in terms of what it's carrying, the pulmonary and systemic circulations are backwards. Okay, one last thing that I think I need to talk about is, so I don't want to talk about the vascularity of the heart, but here we see a heart, and here are the two superior chambers, the atria, and the two lower chambers, the ventricles. All muscle cells have voltage-gated channels, so they can carry action potentials over the surface of these cells on the sarcolemma, which is the plasma membrane. So muscle cells can conduct action potential just like nerve fibers can. Okay, and these action potentials signal contraction of muscle. Alright, so the myocardium, which is the layer that's made out of muscle, can carry electrical signals, right, because it's just like skeletal muscle, has voltage-gated channels. But there is a special region between the atria and the ventricles, which we call the fibrous skeleton of the heart, and I can see it right here. The fibrous skeleton of the heart is connective tissue. It is not muscle tissue. And because it's not muscle tissue, it doesn't conduct electrical impulses. This connective tissue here does not have voltage-gated channels in it, and so this acts as an area of insulation that separates the atria from the ventricles electrically. So electrical signals can't go from the atria to the ventricles except for one area. And the reason why that is because what? This connective tissue prevents electrical signals from freely flowing because connective tissue is not muscle. The other thing that this fibrous skeleton does is that it allows for firm anchoring of all of the valves so that they don't move around when the heart contracts, right? So it kind of anchors the valves in place. But I really want to talk about it in terms of its electrical properties. So the atria are isolated from the ventricles electrically. All right, we're going to come back to that in a second. Okay, so heart valves. The valves between the atria and the ventricles are atrioventricular. On the right side of the heart, it's a tricuspid. On the left side, it's a bicuspid. What's the easy way to remember that? Try before you buy.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Because the one on the right side of the heart has three leaflets, and the one on the right side only has two, but if you can't count them because the heart is dissected, just try before you buy. All right, so tricuspid, bicuspid, and then the semilunar valves all have three cusps to them. So here's the aortic semilunar, here's the pulmonary semilunar. This is the anterior side, this is a more posterior side of the heart. Okay. When we look at other structures inside the heart, like these papillary muscles, we see that papillary muscles are attached to corded tendine then attached to the atrioventricular valve cusp so that the cusps can't invert when the heart contracts. If the corded tendine weren't there holding the valve leaflets in place, right, the atrioventricular valves would just flop back and forth depending on pressure, and then they wouldn't work as a valve. And that would quickly kill the heart. Well, blood wouldn't even flow through the heart, that would quickly kill the person. Okay. All right, so that's it for the valves, but you got to go back and read that. It was mostly review from anatomy. Okay, the cardiac cycle. So the heart is not like an electric pump that once you plug it in, it just whirls around and pumps blood all the time. Sometimes the heart is pumping blood, and other times the heart is not pumping blood. And both phases are very important. So the time when the heart is contracting or pumping blood, we call that is systole. Okay, so that's the contraction phase. And diastole then is the relaxation phase. And for years and years and years, people were very interested when the systolic function of the heart or the contraction of the heart, because everybody thought when somebody had heart disease, that's the part of the heart cycle that deteriorated and needed to be adjusted or somehow bolstered or whatever. But more recently, people are just as interested in diastole. And can anybody imagine why diastolic function is as important to understand clinically as systolic function? Why is diastole as important, or maybe even more important, for understanding how the heart operates in maintaining blood pressure, for instance? Why is diastole so important? Well, think about what the heart is doing. How does the heart pump blood? It contracts. Okay. Muscle fatigue. Oh, yeah, it's got to relax so that it doesn't fatigue. But we're going to see something interesting about, yeah, that could be a reason. We're going to see something interesting about muscle that it can't go into tetanus like skeletal muscle can. Okay? So it's a little bit harder for the heart to fatigue. But the reason I'm thinking of is that when the heart contracts, what has to be in the heart in order for it to pump blood? There has to be blood inside there. Right, if the heart contracts and there's no blood in the heart, well, no blood is going to get pumped out. So diastolic function is so important because the way the heart fills is just as important as how the heart contracts to squirt the blood out. Because if the heart doesn't fill properly, even though it's contracting normally, it can't pump any blood out. So diastolic function is just as important as systolic function. Okay. Both atria contract simultaneously, followed by the ventricles at a little bit later time. The whole heart doesn't contract together. Atria is first, and then the ventricles. All right, let's talk about some terminology right here. So The heart's got to fill. What happens to the heart as it's filling with blood in terms of its volume? Is it getting bigger or smaller? Is the heart stretching out or is it contracting when it's filling? That's right. It has to be able to relax. So good diastolic function means that the heart has to relax so that when blood comes back to the heart, it can fill the ventricles up and the ventricles have to expand as a result of that. And so when is the heart the largest? When has it filled the most with blood? Okay, is it at the beginning of diastole or the end of diastole? Okay, so diastole is relaxation, right? And right at the end of diastole, that's the biggest volume that the heart has. So it's filled during that whole diastolic period. So end diastole is the largest volume inside of the heart. So end diastolic volume is the volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole after filling. But of course, the heart has to relax in order for it to fill. Okay, now stroke volume is the amount of blood that's ejected from the ventricles when it contracts. And so stroke volume has a number. It might be 40 milliliters or 20 milliliters or 50 milliliters. That's just the amount of blood that's ejected from the left ventricle. And not all of the blood that's in the left ventricle when the heart starts to contract gets ejected. There's always going to be some residual amount left in there. Okay. And that residual amount left in the ventricles is called end systolic volume. That's the amount of blood left in the ventricles at the end of systole. Okay, so how can we measure stroke volume? How can we measure stroke volume if we know end diastolic volume and end systolic volume? So what the heck is stroke volume? Stroke volume is equal to the big volume minus the little volume. What's the big volume? Minus? And systolic volume. Right, so if you take the big volume, subtract out the small volume, we get the stroke volume. That's the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart. Okay, so you got to look at that somehow and kind of get it straight in your mind. Okay, that's the stroke volume of the heart. All right, another equation that we're going to use in the next couple of lectures is that of cardiac output. All right, so these volumes are what, in milliliters? Milliliters. So what's got to be the dimension of stroke volume? It's got to be milliliters. Yeah, that's milliliters. Okay, another measurement of the heart is the flow that's coming out of the heart, and we call that the cardiac output of the heart. I don't know if I've talked about this before or not, maybe. Cardiac output, all right, is the flow. It's the volume of blood per time. So what is volume? Okay, so how would we, what kind of dimension does volume have? How do we measure volumes? Like if I say I want a certain volume of a fluid, I'm going to tell you how many milliliters it is, or cubic centimeters, or cc's or something. A cc is a milliliter. All right, so cardiac output is equal to milliliters per minute. That's how much blood the heart is pumping per minute. That's cardiac output. And what the heck is that going to be equal to? That's going to be equal to stroke volume. And what's the dimension of stroke volume? Milliliters, okay, per what period of time? Seconds, minutes, okay, I misled you a little bit, but that's good. But it's the amount of blood that the heart pumps out every time it does what? It beats, okay, or contracts. So it's milliliters per beat, every time the heart beats, okay? Millimeters, and we could put beat right here too. Every time the heart beats, for one heartbeat, however long that takes. And you're going to see, well, we don't care how long it takes in time, okay? So cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times something else, and that is your heart rate. What's heart rate? What are the dimensions of heart rate? Beats per minute. All right, so we're going to say beats per minute. All right, so look what happens. We have a beat over here in the denominator and a beat up over here in the numerator. What happens? Yeah, forget about them. What are we left with? Milliliters per minute. per minute, which is what? Equal to the correct dimensions for cardiac output. Okay, so that's how these things relate to each other. End-diastolic volume and systolic volume is related to cardiac output. Okay, cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. And, of course, you should know, what's the relationship between cardiac output and stroke volume? Is it inversely related or directly related? It's directly related, right? So if stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases as well, right? If heart rate increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases as well. And if both stroke volume and heart rate increase, what happens to cardiac output? That really increases, okay? Okay. Okay, so those are some important equations that we're going to be looking at. Let's see what else might be next. Okay, as the ventricles contract, the pressure rises inside the ventricles. And remember, oh, sorry. Okay. Wow, that's a nice wide-angle lens. Okay, so as the, so how is a fluid going to flow? How is a fluid going to flow? Like blood. Blood's a fluid. High pressure to low pressure, right? When the ventricles are relaxed, there's low pressure in the ventricles, so blood flows in. As the ventricles start to contract, what happens to the pressure inside the ventricles? It starts to increase. Yeah, it increases. Take a balloon and squeeze down on it. The pressure increases, right? Okay, so as the ventricles contract, pressure increases. The pressure in the atria is low, so blood will want to go from a ventricle up into the atria. We call that retrograde. That's going to kill the person and the heart. What prevents that retrograde flow? AV valve, right? The AV valve. And so the AV valve closes as soon as the pressure begins to develop in the ventricles, starts to fall back, but it snaps those AV valves closed during ventricular systole. Okay, so now the AV valve is closed, but there's still low pressure in the ventricle, there's high pressure in the aorta, blood is going to want to go back from the aorta into the ventricles, but what's preventing that from happening? The semilunar valve. The aortic semilunar valve is closed. So right when the ventricles start to contract, both valves are closed to the left ventricle. The atrioventricular valve is closed, and the aortic semilunar valve is closed. The heart is contracting, but can the blood go anywhere if both valves are closed? It's stuck inside the ventricle. It can't squish out one way or the other. All right, and since, okay, the size of the ventricle can't change because the blood can't go anywhere. The pressure is still increasing. The heart contracts harder and harder and harder, right? But it's contracting harder and harder and harder, but the volume isn't changing because all the valves are closed. We call that the isovolumetric part of contraction of systole. Okay, so that's like if I were to take that walnut again, put it in my hand, and I squeeze down harder and harder and harder. My hand isn't changing shape, but what's happening to the pressure of that walnut? It's going up, 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 and then all of a sudden, right, it cracks. And what happens in the heart is then that the semilunar valve opens and the heart ejects that blood into the aorta. But during that time, after the AV valve closes and the semilunar valve's open, that's the isovolumetric contraction of the heart. Okay, when pressure in the ventricles exceeds that in the aorta, then the semilunar valve's open and ejection begins. All right, then as pressure falls below that in the aorta, all right, then blood tries to flow backwards from the aorta into the ventricles, and that's when the semilunar valves close. All valves are closed, and the ventricles undergo then what we call isovolumetric relaxation when that happens. And when the pressure in the ventricles falls below the atria, then the AV valves open up, and blood flows from the atria back into the ventricles. Okay, so let's look at this graph right here. Not as good as the graph that you have in your lab book. As a matter of fact, with a pencil, you might want to draw in some of these other curves. Okay, and I know you had a lot of fun with this one in your lab. Okay, do you have your lab book? Yeah? You might want to just kind of open it up to where with the quiz at the back. All right, so what do we see? Man, it was freezing in here earlier today. Now it's hot. Are you hot over there? You're still cold? I don't know. I must be.
Cold.
Okay. Okay, so here we have a plot of a couple parameters versus, what's this axis down here? It's not labeled. That's a sin. What should that axis be down here? This is? That's time.
Right.
Oh, you got, oh, okay. Indeed, it is on the top. I should wear my upside down glasses so I could see it then. Okay, so we have a plot of pressure versus time. Oh, no. Yeah, no, that is pressure. Yeah, pressure versus time in the left ventricle. And then this is a plot of volume of the left ventricle versus time. And here we have a sonogram. This is the noise that the heart is making versus time. And how many noises do you see for a heart cycle? This is one complete heart cycle, which includes systole and diastole. There's two. You see two heart sounds. First one and second one. So let's analyze this. Okay, so this blue curve right here it just represents pressure changes in the left ventricle. And you can see that, let's start with diastole. That's maybe the best place to start. All right, so here's the beginning of diastole right here. Look at the pressure in the ventricles. What's the pressure? It's what? Zero. It's really close to zero, right? So after ejection of the blood, the pressure in the ventricles goes to zero, all right? And it stays pretty much at zero all the way during diastole because the muscle is not contracting. But during diastole, what is happening? Let's look at this volume curve. Look at the volume of the left ventricle. It is increasing. Why is that? Because blood is flowing back to the heart and it's filling the ventricles, so the ventricles expand as a result of that. There's no pressure changes. The ventricle is just expanding because venous return is filling up the left ventricle. And then we get to this point right here and we see a little bump. So the ventricles enlarge. Another little step right here. What the heck could this be due to? Okay, so this is due to contraction of the atria. Remember, the atria contract first, and then the ventricles, so the atria pump a little bit extra blood into the ventricles, stretch it out a little bit, and you see when the atria contract, that even increases the pressure inside the ventricles a little bit. Okay, but as you can see, this is a small change compared to this change. So the atria really don't do a whole lot in terms of human physiology. Right? There can be a tremendous amount of atrial pathology, and clinically we're not concerned with it, as long as it's not producing blood clots. Okay? Alright, so after the ventricles contract, so here is this little bump right here. So this is contraction of the atria. Alright, so then what happens? What contracts after the atria? SA node is conduction, so it's an electrical signal. I'm still talking about contraction, which is producing tension. So electrical activity and tension are not exactly the same thing. All right, so after the atria contract, the ventricles contract. All right, so when the ventricles start to contract, all right, pressure develops inside the ventricle, and immediately the pressure in the ventricle is higher than the left atrium, which you might see in your lab book. Oh, wow, you have a nice color diagram in your lab book. I didn't used to have that one. Okay. And as the pressure inside the ventricle is higher than pressure inside the atrium, what happens? Pressure in the left ventricle exceeds that in the atrium. Where does blood want to flow? Back up into the atrium, but can it? What's in between the left ventricle and the left atrium? A valve, right? The bicuspid valve. So as soon as the pressure increases in the left ventricle, the bicuspid valve, the bicuspid atrioventricular valve, slams closed. And when it slams closed, it's a fairly violent reaction, and it produces a heart sound. So it produces the first heart sound. So make a note. What produces the first heart sound? Opening or closing of a valve? Closing of a valve. Which one? Semilunar or atrioventricular? Atrioventricular valves. Right. When the ventricles develop pressure. Okay. So now, from here, this is the AV valve closes. Right. So now all the valves are closed in the heart. So this rapid rise in pressure right here, blood can't leave the heart. let's superimpose, at least in our mind's eye, what does systemic blood pressure vary between? And let's just stick with a normal individual. What is systemic blood pressure when you measure it with a pressure cuff on somebody's arm? 120 over 80. So the lowest it gets is 180 at the end of diastole, right? So we could draw, so here's 80. Right, so as soon as, so the pressure in the aorta is at 80 millimeters of mercury at the end of diastole, and as soon as the pressure in the ventricle exceeds 80, which is this level right here, what happens in this region here? Because right in that region, all of a sudden, the pressure in the ventricles is higher than the aorta. Pressure in the ventricles is higher than the aorta. Which way is blood going to want to go? It's going to want to go from the ventricles up into the aorta. But what has to happen when that happens?
Contraction?
Well, the ventricle is contracting. So what's between the ventricle and the aorta? A semilunar valve. So in order for blood to go from the ventricle into the aorta, that valve has to open.
Oh, okay.
So right at this point right here, right around 80 millimeters of mercury pressure inside the ventricles, the semilunar valve opens. Right, so between when the atrial ventricular valve closes, which is here, and when the semilunar valve opens, the size of the ventricle can't change. And we see that right here. See this nice plateau region? The size of the ventricle can't change. And what do we call this region right here, number one?
Okay.
It's contracting, but what about the volume? Is the volume changing? No. It's called isovolumetric contraction. So between these dotted lines, that's isovolumetric contraction because both the AV valve is closed and the semilunar valve is closed. That's isovolumetric contraction. And then, after the semilunar valve opens, what happens to the pressure in the aorta? It goes up to 120, which matches the pressure inside the ventricles. And as blood is being ejected, and but when you look at the volume curve, you see the volume of the left ventricle is decreasing because what's happening to the blood? It's being ejected out of the left ventricle, right? And the heart is still contracting, but if there's no longer any blood left in the left ventricle, it's not going to boost the pressure anymore. So pressure is going to start to decrease in the ventricles, right? But the aorta, the pressure is not going to decrease so fast. It's going to take, what, more of a track like this and then slowly go down to what level? 80, right, because that's diastolic pressure. So the aorta is going to have a curve that kind of looks like this. It's going to come over here, and then it's going to bump up, and then it's going to go down exponentially to 80 again. And then what's going to happen? It's going to bump up and go down to 80 again, okay?
So over there would be left.
So, yeah, that would be diastole. Right here. Okay. So your systemic pressure only varies from 120 to 80, but your ventricular pressure goes all the way from 0 to 120. Right after it ejects blood and the semilunar valve closes, when does that semilunar valve close? As soon as the pressure in the ventricles goes below the pressure in the aorta, which is going to be right about in this area here. That's when the semilunar valve closes. When blood tries to go backwards, retrograde, from the aorta into the left ventricle. And when the semilunar valve closes, what happens? It makes a big noise. And what do we call that?
Dup.
Noise.
Dup.
Yeah, we call it the second heart sound. If you want to call it dup, that's fine, but that's the second heart sound. Okay, so the second heart sound is caused by opening of a valve or closing of a valve?
Closing
of a valve, just like the first heart sound. But the first heart sound is due to closing of the atrial ventricular valves. The closing of the semilunar valves is due to, produces the second heart sound. Right, so make sure you can say that correctly. Okay. It's really hot up here in the front of the room. Okay, so those are the two normal heart sounds. Okay, so that's what we have on all these slides right here. But you can't have abnormal conditions in the heart that produce abnormal sounds and noises. Maybe squirting sounds or squishing sounds or squeaking sounds or rushing sounds. Not clear, crisp, lumped ups. Okay? And that's due to abnormal flow patterns in the heart. And some of these abnormal flow patterns can be due to defective heart valves. They can be congenital in origin, which means what? You're born with them. Maybe it happened developmentally before you're born, or it could be a genetic predisposition. Who knows? Okay. But other times, it can be produced developmentally. You can acquire these abnormalities as you live your life due to infections. Maybe rheumatic fever. I heard a really interesting case of MRSA attacking somebody's semilunar valve. That was a total mess. It's amazing this guy's still alive. After class, if you're interested in hearing that, it's a very interesting story. It was on Discovery Health Channel, but it happened right here at Harbor UCLA. It's amazing they could save this guy's life. So heart valves can be damaged by different kinds of infections. All right, and then if the heart valve is damaged, is going to be produced one of two different kinds of abnormalities. Maybe it won't close properly, or maybe it won't open properly. If it doesn't open properly, the heart won't fill, but if it doesn't close, then the heart will lose systolic function. If it doesn't open, diastolic function is impeded. If it doesn't close, that impedes systolic function. Okay, so microstenosis is when the heart doesn't open properly. So the ventricles have trouble filling. And since they don't open properly, as blood flows from the atria to the ventricles, it makes a swirling or swishing sound, which you can hear with a stethoscope. Okay. And that will produce a murmur. When valves don't close properly, right, we call that an insufficient valve or an incompetent valve. So when the ventricles start to contract, blood squirts very loudly from the ventricle back up into the atria. Okay, so let me see if I turn around. Can I see what's going on here? No, this is a different circumstance altogether. But you can imagine, for instance, if there's damage to this tricuspid valve right here, if it doesn't close properly when the right ventricle contracts, blood is going to squirt back up into the right atrium. Right, that's a heart murmur. There can be other conditions, too, that produce abnormal sounds. For instance, if there is a septal defect, if there is a hole in the interventricular septum, blood is going to squirt from the left ventricle into the right ventricle when the heart contracts. And that's going to make a terrible noise as well. That's not going to correlate with the first heart sound and second heart sound. It's going to cause a squeaking sound. And why is it going to flow from the left into the right ventricle over here? How does the fluid flow? High pressure to low pressure. Which ventricle is stronger, the left or the right? When you just look at the heart, because the myocardium is a lot thicker on the left than the right. But why is that exactly? Why is the left stronger? Yeah, it's got to pump blood through the whole systemic circulation. It requires higher pressure to do that. The right ventricle only has to pump blood through the pulmonary circulation, requires much less pressure, the muscle is not as strong, so the left ventricle produces much higher pressure than the right. So when there's a hole here, when the ventricles contract, it's got to go from the left into the right ventricle because it's always higher pressure in the left ventricle. Okay, so blood is going to squirt over here, and of course you will hear that, and that's going to kill the heart eventually too. All right, so that has to be repaired. All right, in the fetus, right, there is a foramen between the right atrium and left atrium because in the fetus, blood doesn't need to go to the lungs for oxygenation. In the fetus, where is the blood getting nutrients and oxygen from? The placenta, right? So blood has to go to the placenta, but not the lungs. So blood is shunted away from the lungs. It's passed directly from the right atrium into the left atrium, bypassing the pulmonary circulation through, can you remember what this hole is between the right and left atrium? That is, it's a foramen, but we don't call it a foramen. Oh, it is. It is called a foramen. It is the foramen ovale. Okay, so that's in the fetus, but as soon as you're born, what should happen to that hole? When you're born, do you need your lungs? Absolutely, because you need to start breathing. So that hole should heal over, so there's some flaps of skin of endocardium that close the hole over, right, and that prevents the flow of blood. But in a lot of people, that hole remains patent. right? And so we call that a patent foramen ovale. And some people can live pretty normal lives until their 40s, maybe even their 50s before it causes clinical problems. And then they start having cardiac problems and somebody does a nice image and they say, oh, well, you have a patent foramen ovale between the right and left atrium. And that has to be repaired. Otherwise, you're going to lose cardiac function. And so that's going to produce abnormal sounds as well. Okay, so that's not, depending on what degree it heals over at birth, it causes more or less problems. So there might be somebody in this room that has a patent foramen ovale. And fortunately, about 5 years ago, somebody figured out a way to do this orthoscopically. All right, it used to be open heart surgery to go in there and suture things up. Which means what? Well, you got to rip somebody's chest open, you got to get through the pericardium, you got to rip somebody's heart open, and of course you can't work on somebody's heart when it's beating, so you got to stop the heart, you got to go on bypass. I mean, a big, huge mess, right? And some guys at Stanford, maybe some gals too, I don't know, probably, figured out how to thread catheters up through the veins in your legs to work on that patent foramen ovale and just suture it all closed. So you're probably out of the hospital in a couple of days, or maybe even that night. I'm not sure how things are going in the hospital anymore, as opposed to having that major thoracotomy, okay? So that produces heart murmurs. Okay, electrical activity of the heart. So don't forget that myocardial cells, all right, the muscle cells are specialized for contraction because they're muscle cells, but they have a lot of similarities with nerve cells, with neurons. How can you explain to me or describe to me why a muscle cell has a lot of similar electrical properties compared to neurons? What about the membrane? What can you tell me about the membrane of muscle cells and neurons that allow them to have a lot of similar electrical properties? What do they have? They have action potentials, and why do they have action potentials? Because they have voltage-gated channels, like sodium channels, voltage-gated sodium channels. So when sodium enters a cell, that depolarizes a cell, and if it's a sufficient depolarization, it's self-propagating, right, and can transmit that as an electrical signal. Okay, so myocardial cells are short, and they're branched, and that's a lot different compared to skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle is what? Long and linear, right? Cardiac muscles are short. And the nice thing about, what's the functional and structural unit of communication between cells called? A synapse. That's a synapse, and there's two kinds of synapses. There are chemical synapses that require neurotransmitters, and then there are electrical synapses, of which there are not many in your body. But in the heart, it's loaded with electrical synapses. Okay, and electrical synapses are due to that membrane component, which we call what? It's in this first gap junction. So a gap junction is a sodium channel which allows sodium current to move from one cell to the next, causing the next cell to depolarize, which then that sodium current goes to the next cell, which causes the next cell to depolarize. And of course that happens very quickly as an electrical signal. So the myocardium contracts as a unit because it has electrical synapses. Okay, between myocardial cells. Now, where is there a part in the heart where it isn't continuous myocardial cells? There's a space, there's a place in the heart where there's a separation between myocardial cells. I mentioned that earlier in lecture today. The septum is all made up of myocardial cells, both the interatrial septum and interventricular septum, but between the atria and the ventricles, you don't have myocardial cells. What do you have in between there? You have that fibrous skeleton of connective tissue. That's why the atria can contract first or conduct electrical information first, and then the ventricles get it later on. All right, and because of these gap junctions or electrical connections between all the cells, we say that the myocardium is a functional syncytium, that all those cells will depolarize together, and then they're all contract together. And that's because action potentials originating in any one cell can end up being transmitted to all the cells. Okay, so let's take a look at, let me see if I have a picture. Next slide. Let's look at, I sure don't. Okay, I don't.
It's called the connective tissue?
The fibrous skeleton. The fibrous skeleton. Okay, so if I draw this on the board, what kind of muscle fiber does that look like? You're right, that's skeletal muscle. So if this end depolarizes over here, depolarization is just going to go in this direction. When it gets to the end of that cell, it's going to stop. So only this one fiber is going to contract. But skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, looks like this. These striations mean what? It has sarcomeres, right? And then here is another, I guess I got to make something special here with some gap junctions in there. Here's another cell, and here's another intercalated disc, and another myocardial cell going like this. So what can you tell me about myocardial cells? Are they long and linear, or what? They have? It has these branching patterns, right? So not only can electrical signals go from left to right, but electrical signals can always go, what, from top to bottom in this diagram, because myocardial cells are branched. So not only do electrical signals move along the long axis of the heart, but the whole thickness of the wall gets stimulated because these cells are branched. So it spreads up, but it also spreads out. So that's the importance of having branched cells within the myocardium. Okay. Well, there's one area in the heart that the whole heart spontaneously depolarizes. How do you understand depolarization? What's a good way for you to appreciate depolarization? What's happening for depolarization? Oh, yeah, you almost said it. Sodium channels, right? Sodium channel opens up, sodium enters the cell. Okay, well, in the heart, there are special sodium channels that automatically open. When the membrane potential reaches a resting membrane potential, these sodium channels automatically open up. Not all of a sudden, dramatically, producing an action potential, but they start to leak. And as they leak a little bit of sodium, what happens to the resting membrane potential? It slowly depolarizes. Right? And as it slowly depolarizes, when it gets to threshold, what happens? Action potential. And then it repolarizes to resting membrane potential, but then those leak channels open up, and what happens? Slowly depolarizes until it reaches threshold, then an action potential. So all myocardial cells are what we call autorhythmic. They all have these leaky sodium channels causing these cells to depolarize at a particular rate, and the part of the heart that has the fastest rate or the leakiest sodium channels, the steepest slope, is in the right atrium near the orifice or the entrance to the superior vena cava, and we call that the sinoatrial node. And once that area reaches threshold and depolarizes, that causes depolarization to flow over both atria because it's a functional syncytium. So the sinoatrial node is what we call the normal pacemaker of the heart because it has the fastest automatic rhythm. All the other cells inside the heart will slowly depolarize, but at a much slower rhythm. All right, so they don't really act as a pacemaker because they're too slow. So that slow, spontaneous depolarization is what we call a pacemaker potential due to those leaky sodium channels right here in the SA node. So if we look at the electrical potentials of cells, myocardial cells, in particular nodal cells in the SA node. Okay, so here we see that SA node cell, this is just the electrical activity versus time of one cell in the SA node. Once it reaches resting membrane potential, it doesn't sit there. It starts to depolarize very slowly. And that depolarization is due to, even if you haven't read the book, you would say it's due to some kind of sodium channel. And these channels are what we call HCN channels, all right? And it's due to sodium entering the cell, and when it reaches threshold, then there are voltage-gated calcium channels that open up. And where is calcium high? Outside or inside the cell?
Outside.
Outside the cell. So when calcium channels open up, calcium enters a cell, that's a positive charge, just like sodium. What does that produce? That produces depolarization. Okay, so that's depolarization, and then potassium channels open, which cause repolarization. When it gets down to resting membrane potential right here, look, those HCN channels for sodium open up, and the cell just automatically starts to depolarize. And this happens over and over and over again. And the cells of the SA node have the fastest rate of depolarization right here, so it captures the rhythm of the heart. You want to know what HCN stands for?
Yeah.
No, you don't.
Oh, I don't.
They're sodium channels that spontaneously depolarize. They open when the heart reaches resting membrane potential. Okay. As opposed to most sodium channels that you're aware of only open when threshold is reached. Okay. But these are different. They open when it reaches the resting membrane potential. They're not very strong or powerful, but it causes just a slow depolarization of the cell. Okay, rhythmically. Okay, so these are the nodal cells. Other tissues in the heart are spontaneously active, just like the nodal cells, but they are slower. Right, so they don't regulate the heart rate. They can't capture the heart rate because they're too slow. Okay, now myocardial cells compared to these nodal. So here's a nodal cell. You can see that its resting membrane potential is like minus 55, right? Maybe minus 60. But the resting membrane potential of the rest of the myocardial cells is minus 90, right? So they have to depolarize to a much greater degree before they reach threshold, so it takes a lot longer. So therefore, myocardial cells, the muscle cells that actually contract, really don't normally act as pacemakers in the heart because they depolarize way too slowly. Okay. But when an action potential from the SA node reaches these cells, that's going to cause an action potential because there are voltage-gated sodium channels. And this is what an action potential looks like, okay, from a typical myocardial cell. And you can see it looks a lot different than that nodal cell. Here's a nodal cell. And it looks a lot different than an action potential from a neuron. What does an action potential of a neuron look like? You have a picture in your mind? You had to draw it out. It's just what? Here's RMP, depolarization, repolarization, a little bit of hyperpolarization, and there you go. Right? That's just a regular action potential. And you know what ions are producing what in these different regions? Can you remember that? Probably. Okay. But look at this action potential. It's a lot longer, because it has a plateau phase right here. It has different channels, different ion channels inserted into the membrane of these myocardial cells. Okay, so when an action potential reaches a myocardial cell, maybe through a gap junction, sodium is going to enter the cell through that gap junction, and that's going to trigger the opening of other voltage-gated sodium channels. So you have this very steep rise in the action potential because sodium is high outside the cell. It rushes in very quickly. And as the membrane potential opens, it opens some additional calcium channels in the cell that are slow to open and they're slow to close. So calcium is going to diffuse into the cell, right, because it's high outside the cell. And as calcium enters, is that going to change the membrane potential at all? Well, what about if sodium enters the cell? Is that going to change the membrane potential? Yeah, it's going to depolarize it. And since sodium is a cation and calcium is a cation, it's going to have the same effects. Right? So it's going to maintain depolarization. So you have, because these calcium channels are open, that maintains the depolarized state of that myocardial cell. And then, of course, they slowly start to close and the potassium channels are still open, and that causes repolarization. Okay, now in the action potential right here, right, of course it's an all or none response, but what can you tell me about when is it possible to elicit another action potential? Could you elicit another action potential here? And we said no, because this is the absolute refractory period, right? So don't forget about refractory period. And then here is the relative refractory period. So action potentials don't summate. Same thing for this action potential. It can't summate. And before contraction can occur, there has to be an action potential, right? If action potentials could summate, then even muscles could, or neuron signals could summate, right? But only graded potentials, not action potentials, can sum together. The same thing for an action potential on a myocardial cell. So the absolute refractory period for a myocardial cell is what? It's really long. That prevents the heart from going into tetanus because of the plateau phase of this action potential right here. So do you think that that's a good thing? I mean, you've been walking down the street and you get tetanus in a muscle, it cramps, a skeletal muscle. What would happen to you if all of a sudden you had a muscle cramp in your heart? Well, you'd croak, right? 3 seconds, you'd lose consciousness, 3 minutes, and you'd be brain dead, right? So these calcium-gated channels in the myocardial cells prevent the heart from going into tetanus, and that, of course, is very protective of the individual. Okay, so the plateau results from a balance between the slow calcium influx and the calcium efflux, and repolarization is due to the calcium channels opening up. And the plateau phase lasts for about 300 milliseconds, and that extends the absolute refractory period. So the heart muscle can't contract again. It can't go into tetanus, which is real important. Because in order for the heart to pump blood, what has to happen? The muscle has to relax, the heart has to fill, right? So the heart can't pump blood when it's in tetany because it can't fill. Okay, so let's get back to the conduction system of the heart a little bit. And I think you probably talked about this in lab some already. And that is the SA node is a normal pacemaker of the heart because it has those pacemaker potentials due to the HCN channels that cause depolarization over both ventricles, both atria. We said that the atria are isolated from the ventricles because of the fibrous skeleton and the valves right here. But there is one way for electrical signals to get into the ventricles from the atria, and that's via the atrioventricular node. Atrioventricular node is a muscle fiber, but it doesn't really contract. It just passes on action potential, so it's actually kind of acting like a nerve, but it's not neuronal tissue. It's just a modified muscle. And it conducts action potentials very slowly. So it delays the signal, the electrical signal, from entering the ventricles. So the atria contract first. So depolarization is not the contraction of these muscles. It's what? Just the electrical signal to start that. There's always going to be a latent period between the electrical signal and when the muscle actually starts to contract. Does that ring a bell? Latent period? Okay, so physical contraction and the electrical signal are related, but they're not exactly the same thing. So the electrical signal gets this AV node. It's delayed. It's passed on to the AV bundle, which another name is the bundle of His. And there it picks up speed. And right about at that time, the atria are contracting, but the ventricles are still relaxed. So when the atria contract, that helps fill the ventricles with blood. The signal races very quickly down the atrioventricular bundle through the bundle branches all the way down to the apex of the heart. And there, that electrical signal is allowed to leave the conduction system, and it leaves via Purkinje fibers, which then stimulate all of the myocardial cells, and they're all connected with gap junctions, so the action potentials sweep over the whole myocardium, causing the ventricles to contract. All right, now what part of the ventricles contract first? Okay, atria contract first and then the ventricles. We don't have Purkinje fibers until it reaches this apex of the heart. So the apical regions contract first. And then that wave of depolarization sweeps up the free walls of the ventricles, and then they start to contract. So which way do the ventricles pump blood? Is it from the apex up to the base? Or does it start contracting at the base, forcing blood down into the apex? It starts at the apex, all right? So the apical regions of the heart contract, and forces blood up toward the base, because where are the arteries at? They're up at the base of the heart, so that ejects blood into the arteries, the pulmonary trunk and the aorta. So the apical regions actually contract a little bit before the basal regions of the heart contract because of this conduction system. Okay, so what are the parts of the conduction system? SA node, that's otherwise known as a pacemaker, AV node, AV bundle, bundle branches, and then Purkinje fibers in that order. And that conduction system are muscle fibers, but they're not specialized to contract as much as they are specialized to conduct action potentials, distributing that excitation throughout the whole myocardium. Okay, so for instance, if somebody has a heart attack that kills a certain part of their heart, like for instance, the AV bundle right here, guess what? That forms a scar, which doesn't conduct electrical information. So now the atria are forever isolated from the ventricles. So the atria will beat according to when the SA node depolarizes. But remember, all myocardial cells spontaneously depolarize. So there will be another pacemaker that develops in the ventricle someplace. It's going to be a slower rate than the atria, but the ventricles will still contract at their own rhythm. But it's going to be a slower rhythm. So the atria will contract faster, and the ventricles will contract slow. I can't do it and talk at the same time. And it won't be coordinated. Usually that's typically not such a big deal, because what can you tell me about the functions of the atria? Not very important. Okay? So I don't know if you could be a professional athlete, like a boxer or something of that nature, but typically it doesn't really manifest itself, except you're going to notice some abnormal heart rate even in your everyday activity. Okay, so I think I talked about all this kind of stuff. Yeah, and the delay in the AV node is just because the AV node has fibers or muscle fibers that conduct much slower. Action potentials in the SA node spread at a rate of about maybe 1 meter per second, right, while action potentials in the AV node only spread maximally at 0.05 meters per second. It's 100 times slower, right? So it acts as a little delay line, making sure that the atria contract first. Okay. Well, there's excitation-contraction coupling in the heart, just like in skeletal muscle cells. Where's the clock? Oh, we got to stop pretty soon. Let's see how many slides can I get? A couple. Okay. Depolarization of myocardial cells open up those voltage-gated calcium channels in the sarcolemma, right? So that's inside the cell. And then that depolarization opens up voltage-gated calcium release channels, and that's in the sarcolemma. So then calcium binds to troponin, which stimulates contraction as in skeletal muscle. So excitation-contraction coupling is almost the same as in skeletal muscle, right? That's a lot different than in smooth muscle, because smooth muscle, what bound calcium in smooth muscle? What's the protein in smooth muscle? Not troponin, but calmodulin, right? Calmodulin. Okay, and then during repolarization and diastole, calcium is pumped out of the cell into the sarcoplasmic reticulum via those calcium pumps. And this slide right here just shows that refractory period. So here, the blue line is the action potential, not of a nodal cell, but of a myocardial cell that's going to contract. The red line right here is the actual contraction of that myocardial cell. Right? So, and that absolute refractory period is very long, so contractions of myocardial cells cannot summate together. Right? So this cell can't be stimulated into contraction until well after, all right, that cell actually relaxes. So a heart cannot go into tetany. Maybe I'll start someplace around here next time. Slide number 63. Okay, but this is a nice slide that justifies in time, not in amplitude, but just in time, what an action potential of the myocardial cell looks like of a ventricle compared to the QRS complex that we can measure on the outside of somebody's body. Okay, and we can see that this, what phase of the action potential is this right here, this ascending limb? What do we call this in an action potential?
Depolarization.
And when does that occur in terms of the ECG? During the QRS complex. And what is this part of the action potential called? That's repolarization. And when does that occur? During the T wave of the QRS, right? So typically in an AMP class, we just automatically memorize what happens during the T wave, and we say, oh, well, that's ventricular repolarization. And now here you can see why that happens. QRS complex is due to ventricular depolarization. That's what you're taught to memorize, and now here you see it in terms of the action potential, what's happening. Okay? Okay, so this is kind of a nifty slide to see, but I'll start here again next time too. All right, so do you have lab tonight? Okay. That means you also get, what, another quiz? No quiz tonight? No opportunity for points tonight? Ah, okay, well, that's nice. That's nice.